Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight on the Elysium Project, the Age of Heroes continues to unfold with Astrid and her guest, Dr. Catherine E.A. Korkivis. And now, without further ado, greetings and welcome, Astrid. How are you?
Greetings and welcome, Hercules. Doing well, and I had just mentioned to Catherine, today is a super full moon, and if I am correct, it is the closest moon time the moon will be to the planet Earth this entire year. So it's a very powerful and special full moon, and very fitting so to have a very special person on. I'm not going to get into Sussex County events and all the different things going on with the nonprofits. I will pass that on to you so that I can spend more time with Catherine. I have to say, Sussex County is just amazing. It's a large county. It has many organizations, both private sector and public sector. Unbelievable nonprofits, and we've talked about these in the past. Beautiful natural sites of landscape here, small businesses, which are so mind-blowing. I mean, you name it, runs the whole gamut. Unbelievable small businesses and freelance writers, musicians, artists, lots of doctors. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing our listeners to Dr. Catherine Korkivis. She is a resident of Sparta with a multitude of talents. So first, I'd like to say welcome, Catherine. It's a pleasure to have you here.
I'd like to say thank you very much, Astrid, and also to Hercules for this opportunity to be here tonight with you.
Well, the thing about Hercules is, and I always sing his praises because it's very rare that someone has a platform where you can introduce new material, talk about all the things happening, and he's about communication, communicating things about politics, just putting it out there, this different factors about politicians, the environment's a really big issue, and we always present interesting people that have given so much of themselves, and I have to say, you surely have. And before we get into the writing, because the writing is such an important aspect of your life right now, I really think we need to let our listeners in on your accomplishments. I looked at your bio and the amount of education. I am impressed. And if I miss anything, please fill us in. But an MS and a PhD in chemical physics from Columbia University. PhD and postdoctorate work in biophysical chemistry from NYU in the city.
Correct.
Postdoctoral work in experimental hematology from Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University. And then you top it off with more, a Master's of Business Administration, an MBA in International Marketing and Business at Rutgers, a master's degree in educational leadership and administration from Centenary College. It takes my breath away how much you have done in terms of procuring an education in a variety of fields. I mean, it wasn't just vertical. You also went horizontal. And besides that, you are fluent in a multitude of languages as well. Am I not correct?
That's correct. Yes, every one of those degrees and so on were appropriate for what I was doing in my life at the time. So they fit in beautifully. And I think it helped build my foundation.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, you are both a right brain and a left brain person because I look at the different things you've studied, and then yet you still have that creative aspect that so many of we lefties have. So, I mean, you have managed to blend it all. And I assume that after you got your degrees, you procured your degrees, you started off professionally within the business industry. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I actually started in the biotech industry, and that was pretty much right out of school, after I finished my postdoctoral work. And I was paid to do my original research in biochemistry, which was wonderful for somebody straight out of school, if you wish. And as part of that position, I taught at many universities and developed new technologies for them. And with those new technologies, I had the opportunity to travel throughout the U.S., Canada, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and the Far East. And from my perspective, it was a wonderful experience for somebody in my early 20s. And I could teach and write at every turn. And eventually, I realized how much I enjoyed teaching and writing and returned to my passion. So today,
okay,
I'm a writer of...
That's amazing. But professionally, you have done so much. And you started off in industry, but you went on to the teaching aspect, which I thought was amazing. And you've taught at private schools and public schools, from what I can see. And could you elaborate on some of the courses that you taught? It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, most of what I taught was physics and chemistry, predominantly. I taught AP physics, AP physics B, AP physics C, which is with calculus. I taught honors physics, AP chemistry, honors chemistry, and biochemistry, organic chemistry. I also taught on the college level as well.
Wow, and also robotics.
Correct. And what happened is when I was in industry, I wanted to teach, and one of the things I decided to do was to check whether or not I would like teaching full-time. So while I was still working as a biochemist, I actually taught at Middlesex College. This was in Connecticut, and taught courses in biochemistry and organic chemistry and loved it. Within 2 weeks, I realized this is what I want to do, and then ultimately decided to teach full-time. I forgot you also asked me a question. I apologize.
Oh, no. I was just so amazed with the teaching aspect. So, and you spent how many years in the teaching field?
This is my 20th year this year.
Wow. Wow. I'm just amazed that you were able to put 20 years into that after doing so much technical and advanced materials within the private sector. But that's not all you have done. you're involved in so many projects, and I was very impressed with one in particular called Christ and Christmas. And you've been doing that since 2009. And I'd like you to elaborate a little bit about it, because I'm very interested in it. And if this is a volunteer thing, I would love to help out, either whether it is with materials or with working with children as well. But could you elaborate on that?
Oh, of course. I belong to our local church is Our Lady of the Lake in Sparta. And about 14 years ago now, so it's been a while, I went to a local shelter for the homeless, and I visited the shelter and realized that a lot of the attendees at the time were families, not just, you know, my image of the homeless was very different coming from Connecticut and coming from the city. I had a very different image, and here were families, young children. And there was one particular young lady, she was about 5 years old, her name was Anna, and she was crying. And I was a brand new parent at the time, and I wanted to see if there was something I can do. So I asked one of the volunteers if I can talk, and the mother who was there as well, if I can talk with Anna and see if there was a way I can help her feel a little bit better. I had the feeling she was frightened by being in this environment. You know, it was different for her. It was strange for her. And I talked to her for a while, and what I found out was that the reason she was upset was because she didn't have her teddy bear to sleep with. So that on the way home, it gave me an idea. Why not create teddy bears, you know, and have children create those teddy bears for other children in the homeless shelters? And that's how Christ and Christmas was born. And fundamentally, the early part of December, we get together. Usually it's the first Saturday in December. We get together at the church, and usually we use McKenna Hall, which belongs to Reverend Brown. And we get together young children in the ages of 5 and 10, and they make them from scratch, the teddy bears. They stuff them and they prepare them and they write a note to the child that's going to receive the teddy bear. They even name the teddy bear. And we have Santa who comes in and help, and the children help him pack a sack with the teddy bears, and then we deliver them to the children in the homeless shelters.
That is just a beautiful effort. It's just amazing, and you have kept up with it. But you also are involved with the choir. You're a lector. You're a Eucharistic minister.
Yes.
You are quite a busy lady and quite diverse, I must say. Your interests are so positive. Your energy is so positive. Now, you did all this. When did the idea of becoming an author, or I should say, publishing your writings, because someone like you, as myself, we write since we're children, and we just put it off to the side, and then we tend to find them later and do something with it or weave it into a published piece. So how did that come about for you?
But I always wrote short stories as a teenager. It was something I enjoyed doing. And I decided to write my first novel at age 16. Now, I had outlined all 10 chapters at that point of the book and had written the first 3 chapters. But then time came, time changed my focus between my education, my career, my marriage, my family. And what happened is the book was always with me, with every physical move I made and always in the back of my mind. And I was hoping one day when I retired that I would finish the book. Well, then the pandemic happened in March of 2020. Our schools closed, and I realized that I needed to finish Josette, which was the name of my book, now, not sometime in the future. So I started writing and during the pandemic, and it was completed and published in 2021. And so it was really the pandemic that, because I lost 3 good friends during the pandemic, and it made me realize that life is short, and you sometimes it's, don't put things off to into the future, which you can do now. So that's where that idea came from.
And could you elaborate a little bit on Josette? Because I found, as you talk about that, I'm going to bring up Daniel afterwards, and I have questions how you integrated these two books and your plans for the future.
Well, Josette is written about the story. It starts with her childhood, but it's written about a story of a young woman who had a very loving childhood, but unfortunately lost her parents at a young age. She then basically is adopted by an uncle, her father's brother, and her uncle is a brilliant musician, but not very socially oriented, and certainly doesn't love having the child around. She's a nuisance for him, so she spends most of her growing years alone in this beautiful home he lives in by the sea, but she's constantly alone. But she has her music to keep her company, if you wish. And he gives her one very important gift, and that's the gift of music. And she becomes a musician, a pianist, and ultimately goes to Juilliard, completes her work in Juilliard and her degree, and gets both a master's and an undergraduate degree in music theory. And during the time in Juilliard, meets Daniel, who's a young professor. And the second book deals with Daniel's upbringing, his life from birth all the way to the time when he meets Josette.
Wow. And this is my question for you. Is this two parts of a trilogy?
Yes.
I had a feeling.
what happened is I started with Josette. That was the book I started when I was 16 and finished it. And people that started reading the book kept on asking me, well, Daniel's in the book, right, but we don't know too much about him because I don't really talk much about his background, mildly in Josette. And they wanted to know more about Daniel. So that gave me the idea to write about Daniel and went ahead and did that. And once I started writing about Daniel, I now have Josette and Daniel, my protagonists, from their childhood to the point where they make a commitment to each other as young adults. And my husband came up with the idea, and he said, well, now you have them as young adults, what happens next? And I decided to write the third part of and create this trilogy called Josette and Daniel, which picks up their lives from the time they get married to the end of their lives at the age of 95 years.
That's amazing.
That's what I'm writing right now.
You're at that point right now, because I was totally unaware that it was going to be a trilogy. But when I read about Josette, and then I hear a mention of Daniel, and then I read, you know, different explanations about the Daniel novel, I'm saying, I wonder if there's going to be a third. When I started doing writing about past lives, I started just talking about situations, but then I started doing them as trilogies, which is why I was wondering if you were doing that, in terms of from the feminine point of view and from the masculine point of view, and then one was outside the circle, and what resulted, you know, whether it was the future, the end of the situation, or so. I found it very interesting when I had read the synopsis of the book, saying maybe there's going to be another one, making it a trilogy. So that is exciting, and you're doing that now.
Wow. I'm doing that right now, and both Josette and Daniel really are considered, I guess if I had to categorize them, they're considered contemporary sweet romance, I guess, ultimately. But the book has more depth to that, especially Daniel, because I talk about some social situations, social conditions. I talk about alcoholism. I talk about homelessness. There are certain topics that are brought into Daniel, which are talked about mildly in Josette, but brought in more depth in Daniel.
Okay, and I see that it's basically, the genre is called the historical fiction. So you are interjecting a lot of things that happened within certain time periods and locations.
Yes.
Really
and
great. Now, when I met you, that's where I really want to go. When I met you, we were talking a little bit about, you know, Greece, and I talked about the highlight moment of my life, one of the most magnificent moments of my lifetime was when I graduated from college and I went all over Europe for 6 weeks with my best friend. And the most phenomenal moment was sitting within the Parthenon on the Acropolis. It just was so eye-opening, and I started doing a lot of writing after that, and I think a lot of it was channeling. And even though I did a lot of writing as a child, but I knew things, even going to Greece, I knew, like, where to turn to get to Syntagma Square. People would say, you know, Yasu, and they would ask me if I was, you know, different things, so I have to alert them that I was not Greek and could not speak except for a few words. So when you mentioned your dad's story, I was totally fascinated, and I really would like you to go into detail as much as you can without giving everything away about the AJK anthology, because the little bit that you told me, it's amazing. It's an amazing piece of work.
My father had the writing bug, too, and he was actually an editor for a Greek-American newspaper for many years and wrote editorials. My mother died passed suddenly in 2009, and when that happened, it was a very difficult loss for my father. They had been married for 45 years, and he just felt that, you know, without her, he couldn't really go on. I knew he had a love for writing, so I convinced him to write. And actually, also, he loved to paint, so I convinced him to do both. I encouraged him. Matter of fact, my husband and I built him a little studio so he can actually paint as well. Well, anyway, he decided to start writing, and he wrote 4 manuscripts. Now, the idea was that the first manuscript was a story of his life. It was a memoir. It was based on really growing up during a very difficult time in the island of Crete. He came from the island of Crete. And he talked about his experiences during the Nazi occupation. I had read some of his stories when I was a child about what he had experienced with the Nazi occupation, So I took his memoirs and put them together with some of his short stories that he also wrote into this AJK anthology. A for Artemis, J for John, and K for Kirkitas. That's the AJK anthology. And he wanted these stories to be translated because he wrote them originally in the Greek, in the language of the Greek language, because he really was more comfortable to write in the Greek language. And I decided that it was time to take those stories and memoirs and translate them and put them together into this anthology, just not just for myself and my sister, but also for our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren someday. Altogether, he's written 4 manuscripts. I finished translating his 3rd manuscript, which is now being published, and the end of this summer, going into the fall, I'll translate his 4th and last manuscript.
Oh, so this involves just 3 of the manuscripts. You still have another one that you're going to incorporate into a book as well.
They're separate books now at this point. The AJ anthology was basically 2 manuscripts combined, because one manuscript was just short stories, an anthology of short stories. Other manuscript was his memoirs. So I combined the 2 to create one particular publication, if you wish. And then the 3rd book, the 3rd manuscript, is called The Price of Passion. And it's about somebody who had all the opportunities in life but made the wrong choices in his life. And it talks about what happens to his life as he goes forward. And that's the 3rd book, and that one's the one that's right now been accepted by Dorrance Publishing for publication. And the 4th book is called Captain Nikolai, and it remembers. And it's about the adventures of a sea captain, which he loves. My father loved the sea. That was his passion, and he wanted to write this person's life, about this person's life. So that one...
Quite a bit of work, and very diverse. And I could see where your gift has come. Definitely, it's a genetic gift, because your dad is so descriptive, and the one story you told me just totally enthralled me. It's so captivating. The story is amazing, and I really don't want to give away too much, you know. But if you could just give us like a couple little lines or descriptions of some of the things in the book. I don't want to go into the full story because it's just so magnificent, and that's something that someone needs to have that book in their hand and read it, because it's just, I was awestruck with that story, totally awestruck.
Well, I think you're referring to the story of his execution, planned execution. My father was a teen during the occupation of Crete, and the way the German army decided to occupy Crete, because it was an island, they had been fighting in the northern part of Greece already, and it was, you know, there was ongoing fighting there, but they hadn't captured the island of Crete as yet, and they decided to capture the island by parachuting, having paratroopers coming into the island. Not by boat, but just paratroopers, because there was, I believe at that time, the British Navy was there, and they felt that they couldn't go in by sea, so they decided to just have paratroopers drop into the island. As the paratroopers were dropping into the island, the locals were basically defending in every way they could. Well, there was also bombing at that time. They were bombing the island. And my father was with his family in the town of, it was called Malame, which is right outside of Kenya on the island of Crete. It's the northern part of the island. And he was went down to the basement, and they were down there trying to avoid getting hurt by the bombing. And my grandmother was a nurse, and she heard moaning outside of the door, the basement door. And they opened the door, and there was an injured German soldier in very bad medical condition. They brought him in, and my grandmother with her friend, who was also a nurse, took care of him, and they hid him, really, because they were concerned that he would be killed. And in gratitude, he gave my grandfather a note that said that if he ever needed anything, he would be there to help him. And so that was sort of the situation. Well, the German army started moving into the various villages, and they moved into a village where my uncle was visiting his cousins and friends, and they lined up all young men between the ages of 18 and 35 in the square of the city, of the town, the village, I should say. And they basically had them standing there, and my father decided that he had to get to the village. He had to go to where his brother was. And my grandfather didn't want him to go by himself because it was too dangerous, but he insisted. And he said, if you don't come, I'm going by myself. So my grandfather went with him. Now, my grandfather had that letter from the German lieutenant in his wallet always, and he carried it with him. So he went with my father to this village. As soon as they walked into the village, the German soldier pulled my father into the mix of young people that were standing in the center of the square. And they announced that they were going to assassinate all the young men because of the fact that the local villagers were fighting. They wanted to assassinate the young men in the middle of the square. And my grandfather panicked, and he went over to the commandant, and he showed him the letter that was written in German, and it turned out that one of the lieutenants that was there was the lieutenant that my grandfather and grandmother had saved. And he basically said to my grandfather, take your sons off the line. And my grandfather tried to take as many boys as he could off the line. He ended up taking, I think, 4 boys off the line. And he was afraid to take more because he was afraid that they would take his sons back again. And he told them to leave the village immediately, which they did. And as they left the village, they heard the gun shooting. And they had assassinated all those young men.
Catherine, there are no coincidences in life. There are no coincidences in life. And that story just, wow. It's an amazing part of that book. I have it on order. I'm getting it already. I'm so excited to read it because aspect of it alone is just...
In the center of the book, there are photos, and those photos are from what Hitler required at the time. He required wherever they occupied, any kind of things like that, assassinations, whatever, had to be photographed. And so they had taken photographs, and you can see my father and my uncle standing in line waiting to be executed. And they put all those in a special place in Berlin. And late 1980s, they opened up this vault in Berlin, and all the pictures were then distributed, whether they were Greece or France, wherever they needed to go, they distributed the pictures. And my father, the Greek government sent them to my father in the United States. And copies of those pictures are now in a museum in Dresden as well. So the book has the authentic pictures from when it was taken during that time, during those assassinations.
That's unbelievable. And it also brings to mind, it makes me think of Dostoevsky's one book where he's awaiting execution. And he lives with the thought of execution for so long, and that death has become, you know, it's his nature now. He cannot think of it in terms of life. So it had to be an amazing experience for him to now have his life reclaimed. And I'm sure not just the fact that he was that close to death, but it gave him a renewed respect for the fact that his life was extended.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Amazing piece.
What it did is, it first off, it was an incredible thing to be there for him. I mean, from the point of view that he was able to save a few people, and made a difference. It made a difference. But he took that whole experience. He went to college. He went to law school. He managed to build a life for himself, and then came to the United States and have a family. So it gave him a future, and he was able to use that future to make a difference for all of us. He was a wonderful father. I called him the intellect and the philosopher.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. And with a very, very deep heart as well, a deep heart and soul, most definitely. Now, I noticed that you had a blog as well. If you go to your site, and we'll talk about all your contact info later, but I had gone to your site, and you have this great blog. You have one blog that is called, the Author's Corner? Yeah, the Author's Corner. And I love this topic. Can reading a particular book influence our life's passions or decisions? Can you talk about these books? You mentioned Charles Dickens being the first, The Tale of Two Cities. And the interesting thing is, you read it when you were 12. My cousins, I had these two cousins that were quite bright. And as a gift, I was given that book when I was 12. And it is an amazing book. So if you could talk a little bit about the books that have fallen into your lifetime to make an impression in terms of your writing and in terms of just what made you Catherine.
Well, I think, first off, I'm an avid reader, so I love to read. And the purpose of the Author's Corner was really to express not just my love of certain books, but also to give people an idea of what those books are about and the kinds of messages they're trying to bring to the foreground. In particular, I love Dickens. Dickens' comments on society is to me so relevant and so real, and he understood what people's human suffering. He understood the aspect of human suffering, but also in his books, I mean, to me, The Tale of Two Cities talks about a character who at the end does the most amazing thing. He gives his life up for somebody else to live. And to me, that's the best gift, the most incredible gift you can possibly give. And I love the fact that Dickens also not only talks about human suffering, but he also talks about the idea of human, how can I put it, the spirit, the human spirit, and how no matter what we go through, it helps us thrive. It helps us to move on. It helps us to build our lives and go beyond. And it's that fighting spirit that's always within us. And that's the other thing that he's managed to talk about in his books. I love Dostoevsky. I mean, I love the Russian authors, if you wish, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. And, of course, you know, scientific writers, science writers, of course. I've written my own science book many years ago, actually. And I also write science fiction, believe it or not. That's some of my short stories, so I'll do a little bit of that.
And as I said to you before we went on air, Hercules has many different platforms. At Age of Heroes, we get into discussing, you know, all the different people who have made contributions to others and community events. You know, I do mostly focus on community. But he has a whole section devoted to space life, and it's amazing all the platforms he has in relation to that. So that would be another interesting topic for Hercules to explore with you.
Yes, it would. Tomorrow we're doing a science fiction show, in fact, called Spaced Out. And we do a lot of Star Trek and other pop culture. Go ahead.
There you go. You've piqued Catherine's interest.
And Catherine also has another blog on space, Today in Space, I believe it's called, full of beautiful pictures of what's going on in the cosmos around us. And I think you tried to start a Facebook page with that as well.
Yeah. Actually, On the website, I have some of it, but on my Facebook, I have a lot of images from the Hubble telescope originally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big lover of nebulae, so you'll see a lot of those. But I also am now putting on the ones from the James Webb telescope, which are phenomenal.
Oh, they're magnificent.
They talk about seeing images 200 million miles away. I mean, we're talking light years, not light years away. So
it's just mind-blowing. It really is. And when they do the comparison, Catherine, from the Hubble to the James Webb, the detail, oh, God.
Amazing. So I'm going to be posting a lot of, and those are going to be also going on to my website as well.
Hercules, she has another blog that is called, it's related to space as well, and when I went on to it, these stunning pictures of the Veil Nebula, the Cat's Eye Nebula, maybe, I don't know if that's on Facebook, because unfortunately I am not on Facebook, but yeah, absolutely beautiful.
Are you into UFOs as well, and next ET speculations and so forth?
I'm sorry, what was that, Hercules? I apologize.
Are you also into ETs and extraterrestrial speculations with like the possible biology of life on other planets?
Well, I don't know what exists on other planets, but I will tell you one thing. I don't believe we're alone. Definitely not alone. Yeah, I mean, I believe that there's life. I mean, it might not be carbon-based life. It could be silicon-based life. It could be energy-based life. But there is life there somewhere in the cosmos. Matter of fact, they just saw there's many Earth-like planets, but one in particular called Kepler-271, I believe it is very much like Earth. It's got water. They've been able to see that. So there's definitely possibilities out there. And it's just a matter of finding them. If we can get to the point of being able to travel long distances into deep space, we'll be able to see for ourselves. And that's why I'm fascinated by Star Trek and Strange New Worlds and all those series. I'm a big proponent of that.
I have to have you on those shows at some point as well. There's a lot of ancient Greek and Roman literature, too, that's science fiction, that talk about the residence of the sun and the moon and the clouds and travels to the planets and so forth. So science fiction goes back a long way. And today I was doing some activities with kids in a summer education program, and we talked about how the days of the week in the Latin languages and in the planets of our solar system tie into Greek mythology. It's a great topic. Okay, I'll leave you back with Astrid.
Oh, no, I'm finding this all exciting because I don't know that much about your shows related to space. Catherine, I have done some episodes with the Hercules on astral travel, and we've talked about different dimensions, traveling with dimensions. My son was visiting, he put on the show, and he said, Mom, I want you to see this. And it was with Doctor Strange. I guess, you know, I haven't kept up with, like, the superheroes. And he was explaining about how now since, you know, Disney owns this or that, he was getting into the business aspect because he is a business person, where I am, like, exactly the opposite. I'm the creative person. But it was with Benedict Cumberbatch, whom I love as an actor. And Jesse's telling me it's all about meta-universes. And as I'm watching it, I'm getting so excited because their word meta-universe to me is what I know is about different dimensions standing side by side and how we can exist simultaneously. But the whole point is that you cannot interfere with them. So I find it unbelievable. Of the games that the kids are playing, the video games, and these shows, how deep they're getting into these things.
Yeah, my son, my eldest, actually is very much into the same thing. He loves superheroes, and he was telling me about a game that he was playing that deals with meta universes and parallel universes, if you wish, and timelines. And Einstein was the first that actually talked about the possibilities. He talked about time being the fourth dimension. So
exactly.
Three-dimensional space moving along a fourth dimension, which is time. So you can have all these parallel universes where events are happening and characters are the same, but they can be experiencing different scenarios. So it's, to me, I'm fascinated by that. I've always read about it. That's right. And my eldest son very much has the same interest as well.
There you go. That scientific aspect, but then again, you know, how they're, because science and math at one point, students weren't that involved with them in high school. They, you know, once puberty comes, I mean, I taught art for a lot of years, and the excitement at one point gets sidelined because adolescence occurs. And but yet they found a way to get students back interested in these things through robotics, through these games, by just bringing them in through the creative aspect and dropping lines and making them curious. Because once they find that concept,
yes,
they'll just Google it.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this. At Mars Catholic, I run a robotics program. I started it there. And I had started in Sparta and worked with Pope John on the robotics program. And we built the large robots. This is part of the first program. And started it there and then moved it off down in Denville for Morris Catholic. And I'm a robotics mentor. And the reason I got involved in that is because it's hands-on, but it teaches engineering skills, it teaches programming skills, and it gets young people to be creative, to think outside the box. They're given a problem that they have to solve by building a robot that will do a series of tasks. And I'm involved in the competitions every year as well.
Oh, wow.
You are. Wow.
Yeah.
This is exciting. I thought it was a special program. Yeah, after I would teach art, they brought a special grant program into the art room, and the school psychologist was teaching it, and it had to do with artists' thinking and inventions. And,
right,
of course, they got into Leonardo da Vinci and his artwork, but they pulled him into the whole concept of inventions and got into the science and the creativity, the both together. That was a really great program for very young children to fuse the two.
I believe in hands-on. I teach physics, and physics is a tremendous amount of theory. And one of the things that can happen, and very heavy in math, what can happen is it can get pretty boring very quickly. So what I do is when I teach is I have hands-on. We talk about the concepts, but we actually try to show the concepts. They build, they create projects. I give them projects where they have to build something to attain to a certain task, whatever that task may be.
Mm.
And there, it's a lot of, I believe hands-on is the way to get them involved and allow for creativity. Even
most
course,
definitely.
Very yeah. And I think
yeah.
what's happening
you're right,
science,
you're right. That is the best way because it becomes ingrained in kids,
yeah,
no matter what educational level they were, you know, that I taught across the board, when it came to hands-on, the concepts can be learned and retained, especially when you
correct
cross over, because I was a proponent of that multidisciplinary approach, so whatever I taught, I analyzed what skills I would quiz the teachers
correct
for each level and quiz them and
yeah
say, okay, what are you teaching this quarter in this subject, that subject? So if you're the sixth graders are learning about Egyptian art or Egyptian culture, we would get them into doing their own papyrus, creating a heretic writing and the other particular kind of writing, doing the illustrations, learning multiple things at one time through creativity. So something like math and science, even more so, you know, it's a great pull and a great way. You're right. The hands-on is the best way. Otherwise, the words just stay words. They don't go into actuality.
Yes, and I mean, one of the things is I think having the hands-on approach, it teaches, it relates to physical learners, it relates to visual learners, it relates to different types of learners.
Auditory learners, you're right. Every single aspect, every discipline of learning, one's left out.
So I think science has gone through, I think, sort of an, I would say it's evolved, because the way it used to be taught is so different today. It's much more different today. And I think by integrating those aspects into a classroom setting, you get the kids excited about learning about science. And that's the future. They need to be, to have a literacy in science. You really need to build that in. And the only way to do that is to have them feel excited about science, because young kids love science. But what happens by the time they get to middle school, they lose that interest. And
right.
Robotics, engineering, hands-on is all bringing that back into the science classroom and keeping those kids interested. I actually teach engineering because, to me, I think we need more and more engineers out there, and I tend to want to see more female engineers as well. And I focus on trying to get them to see that they can solve problems. It's all problem-solving engineering.
You're right.
Yeah, and it teaches them the skills they need to be able to solve those problems. This is the future. We need people out there building bridges or tunnels or coming to, even with climate change, we need these people out there to help us build the future of our world. And so this telescope, the James Webb Telescope, is based on engineers and mathematicians, and we need people like that.
And how many countries put their brains together to do this for how many years? Was it 20 years in the making?
20 years in the making, yes.
Amazing, unbelievable.
It's
just magnificent.
I mean, the whole Artemis program going forward for Mars and the Moon program, it's first the Moon and then Mars, all of that is an international program. It's involved, there's at least 20 different countries involved in that program. So all of these are international in existence, and it's a wonderful thing to see.
Definitely. Catherine, it also, this is the thing that people forget, the hands-on. I remember becoming an art major, first going to college, and one professor saying to me, if you want to be a sculpture major, you have got to work with the material first. You can't make materials or something else, but you have to follow the sequences. There are no shortcuts. And that always stayed with me, because Catherine, no matter what you're doing, you cannot jump out of sequence. You know, you just can't. You have to follow the sequences. You know, it taught me patience.
I'm very analytical, so I follow sequences naturally because I am analytical.
But the thing that you're doing is you're sharing that with the students, and you're teaching them as well to, you know, the necessity of following each sequence, and they get so excited about it. Now, what I find very interesting is you have such an analytical and scientific mind, and you got into these books, like I'm going back to the Josette and the Daniel book, with emphasis on music, in classical music, and I want to know where that came from. Like, what was that desire? I'm sure there's a reason.
Yeah, well, my family was musical in the sense my mom played the mandolin, my sister played the violin, and I've been playing classical piano since I was 7 years old. And I think that was the best gift ever. My parents were insistent that we had music in our lives. And my sister and I would do concerts together when we were young. So it's always been part of my life. I'm a lover of classical music. I love opera. And I wanted to have Josette be a musician, and the same with Daniel. So that's why I put both of those settings as for my protagonists. I also wanted to explore the beauty of music, because it does open us, you know, talk about creativity. You see the world so differently through music. And music can express our emotions so well. I mean, one of the things I love about opera is sometimes you don't need to understand the language. You understand it through the music and the performances. You understand the emotions that are trying to be displayed. So I find that this adds to my life. It's a very important part of my life.
Well, growing up with that, now I can understand why you have such gifts on both sides of your brain, utilizing both sides of your brain, because to grow up with that, I didn't really have that. I had a dad who really did not complete most of his education and was a laborer, but he had his desire was to become a conductor. And he had all the classical music. So from 3 years old on, I was exposed to ballet and the classical music. And Catherine, I'm talking 33 and a third, you know, those large, heavy records. And he had the giant sets of them, and he'd play them from young, you know, so I was very aware of it. And it does instill this this opening of the heart and soul, so that you hold on to that music. And I'm sure with you too, there's certain pieces that bring, when you hear them, that bring back memories and feelings for you.
Yes, I mean, well, my mother was the musical person, really. My father was the writer, if you wish, and the painter, but he was those were his passions. But my mother was music. She had a beautiful soprano voice, and she sang as a cantor in our church. And I used to sit in the front row and listen to her sing and be enthralled. I mean, totally, totally enthralled. And I loved everything about her, in the sense that she was a kind, gentle person, but she would wake us up with song every morning. She would sing us to wake us up. I didn't need an alarm clock. I had my mom. And during the course of the day, she would just sing. And it was always music. She would play the mandolin. There was always music in the household, and to me, growing up with that was just such pleasure and such a blessing, honestly. And I miss that.
And it's a phenomenal influence too, though, because now they've proven that music, you know, there are more grants going towards music because they've proven that it helps develop the brain, and it's phenomenal for math skills. It's not just a creative process. It's what it puts down as a foundation for learning as well, which is it's so great that through analyzation and research and studies, there is so much that has been revealed to us, whether it be Carl Sagan, whether it be, you know, anything in terms of all these different things have been laid down. And what do you feel is the most important influence? And this is hard because there's so many. The most important influence with your writing?
I don't know, I've just always wanted to write. I guess father was the influence because I loved his writing. I loved his stories, and I would read them as a young teen, I guess, and that's what started me to write. I wanted to be able to do what he did, I guess, and he always saw me as a writer as well. He loved reading whatever I wrote, so I had that constant feedback from him as well. But I guess reading the books that I read, too, because I loved classical novels. I loved the Bronte sisters and Jane Austen, and I loved, of course, and I think reading some of those and getting the imagery that they would create and the characters that they would come to life, I wanted to be able to do something like that. And that's where I think I started, back with my father's writings and also with my readings as well.
That's interesting. My dad, not having gone through, you know, finished high school, you know, laborer, but so into the arts, would drive me to the library every Saturday, and I was allowed to take the maximum amount of books as a very, very young child because I was an avid reader as well. And there was a point when they had to say, well, that's it. She's read every book in the kiddie section. We'll have to send her up to adults. But having a dad that promoted that, it is so important, you know, in terms of the reading. And And I can remember that my first love of a book was the Winnie the Pooh, huge book.
Oh, I love Winnie
and
the Pooh.
I was in love, again, as you said, the imagery that was created, that I was so enthralled with each character that, all right, you had it for 2 weeks, you could renew it. I went back, I renewed it, and then I had to bring it back, and I refused. And my father had to take the book forcibly from me to give it to the librarian. But, yeah, and the thing that would disappoint me would be you go to see a movie. No. I had a very hard time when books were made into movie because, as you say, Catherine, the imagery that's created in books.
In your mind. Yeah.
That creates these beautiful pictures, and that's what makes the book last within you, those pictures. Then you go to the movie and you're like, well, I don't know about the movie.
And on that thought, we're going to have to say to be continued. We have around 4 minutes left, and I'd love it for you guys to share your contact information.
Yes.
Okay.
Please do that, Catherine, all your contact info and where we can purchase your books.
Okay. All books are available at Amazon. They're all available there. My father's book is also available in Barnes & Noble's, but they're available as e-books and also as paperback. I decided to have two forms for the books, two formats. They're also, if you go on my website, which is CatherineCorquitisAuthor.com, there as well, there are links to, if you go to the book section of that website directly, there are links to Amazon, so you can purchase the book through the link as well.
Great.
They'll take the Amazon to purchase the book.
Okay. And you also have contacts. You're on LinkedIn. What sites are you on as well? So people would like to contact you that way. How can they do that? Which sites?
I have a Facebook page as well that's dedicated to writing. Future projects, putting all my short stories together in an anthology as well. And that's coming out at the end of this year, 2022. And so that's a series of my short stories. So all of that information goes on both the webpage, the website, as well as also my Facebook page under the name Catherine Corquitis, author.
And I have to just say one thing. You had hooked me up with Alignable, and I'm still in the process of getting that going because I would really like Hercules to be on it. So I have to find a way when I have time with my physical labors here with refixing the deck and staining and this and that. But I really want to do that more involved in terms of showing what Hercules has. So it's not just Astrid, you know, on the Age of Heroes. Hercules goes so far and beyond. So we'll be in the process of that. And I noticed as well there were a lot of Sussex County contacts, which really impressed me because I think I would like to have a few of them as guests on Hercules, the blog, as well.
Yeah, I've just started with all the promotion piece of it. So I created my own company, and it allows me to finance promotion. And one of the things I did is join Alignable because I thought that was a good way to get the information about the books out in the Sussex County, Morris County areas. And Alignable looks like it goes even further. It goes beyond
the
northern county of New Jersey.
One thing I am not is that great in terms of computers. You know, I'm creative. There are a lot. I can do sculptures. I can build furniture. But the computer is not always like the easy thing for me. So I will work with Hercules on connecting with him with Alignable and all his different formats, and with you as well, and other people within Sussex County.
Okay.
I thank
if
you
I
for
can
that, Astrid. We're down to our last minute. Thanks to both of you for an awesome show. And Dr. Catherine Corquitis, you're going to be on again. I'll invite you, and whatever interests you, you're more than welcome to come. And so thank you. And Astrid, you're
thank
awesome.
Thank you, Hercules, and thank you, Astrid, both of you for
my
wonderful
pleasure.
Hour.
My pleasure.
And I've spent a lot of Astrid.
So informative.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who tuned in. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Take care, everybody. And again, thank you, Astrid, and thank you, Kathleen.
And thank you, listeners. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.